Our next guest is Richard Dalbello. Richard Dalbello is the Assistant Director of Space and Aeronautics in the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the Office of the President. He is the Principal Advisor on Space and Aeronautics to Dr. John Holdren, the Science Advisor to the President. In this position, Richard plays a key role in the development and implementation of the administration's domestic and international space policy and program priorities. Prior to joining OSTP, Richard was the Vice President of Government Affairs for Intelsat General. He served previously as the President of the Satellite Broadcasting and Communications Association, and for more than 3 years as the President of the Satellite Industry Association. He also served for 4 years as the Assistant Director for Space and Aeronautics in the Clinton White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. Mr. Dalbello earned a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Illinois, a master's in law from McGill University, and a doctorate in jurisprudence from the University of San Francisco. Please welcome Richard Dalbello.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, George, for that kind introduction. I'm looking forward to this morning because I wanted to talk a little bit about the administration's approach to encouraging innovation. Pursuing innovation, private sector collaboration, creative acquisition approaches have been central themes of the Obama administration. While acknowledging the importance of traditional contracting methods, and indeed, if you look at the ratio of the creative things that we're doing to the things that we're doing with traditional methods, it's of course still over 95% is done in the way that we've always traditionally done things. It's important, but we've actively sought to engage industry to expand the boundaries of the potential partnership. I think it's fair to say that there was some skepticism at the beginning of this process. But even our early critics, I think, have had to admit that the recent record has been pretty darn good. For the first time in history, private spaceships are carrying cargo to the International Space Station. Soon, we hope by 2017, private spaceships will carry both government and private sector astronauts to the station, and perhaps someday beyond. SpaceX recently completed two successful geostationary launches of commercial communication satellites, signaling a return to the United States of the jobs and the revenues that had over the past decades migrated overseas. The Air Force recently announced that pursuing a more flexible bulk buy approach to buying EELVs has created the potential of saving billions of dollars. Both SpaceX and Blue Origin are working on new liquid rocket engines. These are some of the first engines to be developed in this country in a very long time. Late this year, Virgin Galactic may launch its first suborbital flight, opening space to new astronauts. And in that regard, over the last 50 years, I think it's estimated that roughly 500 people have gone to space. The potential development of the new space tourism industry, buoyed by American companies such as Blue Origin, Virgin, and SpaceX means that this number could double over the next 10 years. And creativity and innovation haven't been limited to the launch industry. DoD and NASA are investigating the utility of hosting government payloads on commercial satellites for a range of research and operational missions. Hosting payloads offers the government low-cost access to a variety of space orbits, along with the power and the communication systems required to accomplish complex missions. In the past, one of the biggest challenges to the use of hosted payloads was the mismatch between the build-launch cycle of the very rapid build-launch cycle of the commercial sector and the much more slow development cycle of the government. The recently established hosted payloads office at the U.S. Space and Missile Center is working on a hosted payload solution contract called HOPS. HOPS would pre-qualify major satellite manufacturers and commercial operators to bid on hosted payload opportunities, thereby making it easier to match commercial opportunities and government payloads. The Congress recently expressed their support for many of these ideas in the 2014 National Defense Authorization Act. The Act emphasizes the need for enhanced innovation and flexibility in the procurement process, Section 112, for example, encourages DoD to consider innovative contracting and acquisition strategies to maximize cost savings and to study the desirability of implementing multi-year procurement for the acquisition of commercial satellite services. In addition to hosted payloads, new companies are offering SmallSat and NanoSat approaches to space systems that provide low-cost constellations of satellites designed to replicate the capability of a larger and considerably more expensive system. As this technology is developed, the government industry have searched for new and creative ways to get access to orbit for these systems. One solution, pioneered by NanoRax, is to take advantage of the routine resupply missions to the space station. NanoRax is the first company to own and market its own hardware and surfaces for the ISS. This is helping to create a robust marketplace for space station services. Over the next several weeks, NanoRax will launch 33 CubeSats from the space station in what I believe will be the largest single deployment of satellites in one mission. The hardware for this record deployment was developed by NanoRax with their own money. No government funding was involved. Even though these are contentious times in Washington, there's actually been a broad and sustained bipartisan consensus with respect to encouraging the work of entrepreneurs in space. If we look back a little bit in history, the 94 Launch Act, the 95 Amendment to the NASA Act, the 98 Commercial Space Act, the 2000 Commercial Space Transportation Competitiveness Act, and the 2008 NASA Authorization all provide clear examples of Congress signaling bipartisan support for these ideas. In addition, every president since Ronald Reagan has highlighted and encouraged the role of the private sector in space and encouraged the opportunities for partnership between the government and industry. But introducing creativity into the contracting and acquisition process always results in a certain amount of tension. The federal acquisition regulations are not designed necessarily to encourage innovation. In an environment where almost every major contract is subject to a legal challenge, the FAR environment is designed to emphasize transparency, equal access, and consistency of practice. Encouraging innovation can be a complex blend of politics, policy, and law. In a highly visible area where failure is glaringly obvious. For government lawyers and contract officers, it can be difficult to square the goal of innovative contracting, which often involves some form of complex partnership, with the more formal constraints of the FAR. Of course, some organizations have had a long tradition of creative contracting, though one that always comes first to mind is, of course, DARPA. They have and continue to do a number of creative things with industry. And NASA also has a long tradition of innovative procurement. The National Aeronautics and Space Act authorizes NASA, quote, to enter into and perform such contracts, leases, cooperative agreements, or other transactions as might be necessary in the conduct of its work. This reference to other transactions has come to known in contracting circles as other transactional authority, or OTA. It's NASA's policy to use its broad other transactional authority to further the agency's mission. This, of course, provides a great deal of flexibility because the agency's mission is incredibly large. The expansion of human knowledge, the improvement of usefulness and performance, speed, and safety of aeronautics and space vehicles, and the preservation of the role of the United States as a leader in aeronautical and space technology. So it has a lot of room to maneuver with. Space Act provides authority for reimbursable, that's where a party pays NASA for its services, non-reimbursable, where there's no exchange of funds, and funded agreements, where NASA actually pays to have something done. Since this authority was granted to NASA, seven other specific agencies have been given other transactional authority, including DOD, FAA, Department of Transportation, Homeland Security, DHS, and Energy, Department of Energy. And other agencies can also use the authority if given special, a grant of special authority from OMB. There's no statutory or regulatory definition of what constitutes another transaction, though in practice it's often defined in the negative. An OTA is not a contract, a grant, or cooperative agreement. And the NASA, of course, most recently used this authority when they did the COTS program with SpaceX. In 2008, NASA, in the NASA authorization bill, Congress encouraged NASA to enter into contracts for commercial cargo and suggested at that time that commercial crew services might be a possibility. In 2010, the president's budget embraced the concept of both commercial cargo and crew and sought to fully fund and accelerate these programs. By using its other transactional authority, NASA awarded multiple contracts for COTS. These contracts were milestone-based awards designed to create commercial capability which could be available to NASA. Because it's NASA's policy not to use that authority to procure goods or services, before the COTS program was even complete, NASA let the CRS contract for commercial resupply as a standard fixed-price, FAR-based contract. This creative use of its authorities allowed NASA to greatly accelerate the creation of a cost-effective capability for meeting agency requirements while encouraging the development of a competitive launch industry. One commonly heard concern, and I think it was echoed yesterday and this morning, is that while it may make sense to turn to the commercial industry for cargo services, it's inappropriate and indeed risky for human spaceflight. Michael Lopez Alegria, who was just up here, former astronaut, president of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, and Comstock vice chair, recently wrote a compelling op-ed in Space News where he argued that we need not sacrifice safety in pursuit of lower cost. He points out there's no sliding scale that would allow a little less safety for a lower price. All competitors must meet the certification criteria. Testifying before Congress, Bill Gerstenmaier, NASA's Associate Administrator for Human Exploration, was equally clear. He said, and I quote, NASA will maintain its stringent safety requirements and standards. We have always used contractors to build our space systems. In these programs, we are planning to use an acquisition approach that will allow the contractors more freedom to pursue cost effectiveness, but will still allow NASA the appropriate level of insight and oversight. We will maintain crew safety by way of a crew transportation system certification, and no system will receive this certification until NASA is confident that our personnel will be safe. The final thing that I'd like to talk about today is the administration's focus on grand challenges and prizes. Grand challenges are meant to be ambitious yet achievable goals that can capture the imagination and encourage innovation and breakthroughs in science and technology. As President Kennedy once observed, by defining our goals more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all peoples to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly toward it. There have been a number of examples in the past where focused challenges have had a measurable positive impact. IBM drove advances in computing and artificial intelligence by challenging themselves to beat Kasparov at chess and Ken Jennings at Jeopardy. Google has recruited Sebastian Thrun, the Stanford researcher who won the DARPA Grand Challenge competition for unmanned vehicles and is making significant investments in self-driving cars. Google's fleet of robotic cars is now logged hundreds of thousands of miles, driving in city traffic, busy highways, mountainous roads, with only occasional human intervention. USAID and its partners have launched several grand challenges for development, including Save Lives at Birth and All Children Reading. And last year, NASA announced its grand challenge focused on finding all asteroids that pose threats to the human population and understanding how to respond to those threats. In addition to grand challenges, the administration is also encouraging agencies to increase their use of incentive prizes to meet ambitious goals. Incentive prizes have a long history of catalyzing breakthroughs Incentive prizes work as one tool to accomplish audacious challenges because they shine a spotlight on an ambitious goal without having to predict which team or approach is most likely to exceed. Incentive prizes help us reach beyond the usual suspects to increase the number of minds tackling a problem. In 1714, the British government created the Longitudinal Prize for anyone who could develop a simple and practical method for the precise determination of a ship's longitude. The prize was eventually awarded to John Harrison for his chronometer. Charles Lindbergh won the $25,000 Orteig Prize for making the first nonstop flight from New York to Paris. More recently, in 2004, a private The funded team, led by Bert Rutan, captured the $10 million Ansari Prize for becoming the first non-governmental organization to launch a man into space twice within 2 weeks using a largely reusable spacecraft. Additional companies and philanthropists are getting involved in sponsoring major incentive prizes. Progressive Insurance, for example, sponsored a $10 million automotive XPRIZE for teams that could build a car that could get the equivalent of 100 miles a gallon. As companies and donors come to understand the power of this tool, we will likely see a significant increase in the use of incentive prizes in this regard. So, in summary, I think we're at the beginning of a new era of space entrepreneurship. In addition to the things that I talked about, we also have, in Earth observation, a new generation of entrepreneurs that are entering the marketplace. Companies like Skybox and Planet Labs are offering to take on Earth sensing with constellations of small sats designed to replicate some of the capabilities of the larger but much, much more expensive predecessors. As the uses of weather data have proliferated and attracted a broader range of private ventures, new companies such as Planet IQ and GeoOptics are proposing to offer both to the government and to private companies, weather data information that heretofore had thought to be the exclusive province of the government. In the area of space traffic control, the industry created and led Space Data Association has already shown that the traditional boundary between regulators and the regulated can be reexamined. The commercial satellite industry has the potential to be both a producer and a consumer of space situational awareness information. All operators, both government and commercial, have a strong interest in protecting the space environment. The robotic servicing and refueling of satellites is yet another area where the future collaboration between government and industry looks to be promising. Both NASA and DARPA have significant programs in this area. All space operators have an interest in being able to repair damaged satellites, adjust orbits, and refuel valuable space objects. Satellite communications, the government and industry share a serious interest in the future of laser communications. The technology offers the potential for gigabit-level speeds without the reliance on the increasingly scarce radio frequency spectrum. And I'm sure there will be many, many more new cooperative ventures that we cannot fully define today. But this all must start with an open dialogue, a dialogue between government and industry, between regulators and entrepreneurs, and between financiers and engineers. Maintaining this open and robust dialogue will ensure that our flagship government programs are both technologically dazzling and cost-effective. This dialogue will also help to ensure that the entrepreneurial revolution we are seeing today in space will continue and expand, providing thousands of new high-tech jobs and creating opportunities for a new generation of space heroes. Thank you very much. A couple of questions, if anybody has any questions, but not hard ones, Janet.
This thing on? Hi, Rich.
How are you?
I just wanted to commend you for talking about the benefits of OTAs. A lot of people don't realize that the EELV program was developed as the largest OTA in the government's history, and it was then followed by an initial launch services FAR Part 12 contract. And we even met with Alan and Valen at the beginning of the COTS program and gave them lessons learned from the EELV program in developing that. And then we did an offsite with the Commercial Crew Program, with the former government leaders of the EELV program to talk to them about what they were going to be faced in doing that. So thank you for saying that. A lot of people don't really understand how powerful that tool is.
I think one, the reason I wanted to mention it, it is one of the weakest links in the chain between innovation and government contracting. Is often people say, you'll hear people say, the lawyers won't let us do that. And usually that's code for, I don't want to put any effort into thinking about this. Because actually my experience has been, when challenged, there's all kinds of creativity that the lawyers can bring to the process. And you just have to be willing to ask that question and follow where it goes. So it's something that the flexibility exists out there, and if people just need to start using it. And that's why we're so very interested in continuing to work with NASA on what is coming after. I know they're doing a lot of thinking about that. What follows the COTS program? And it's the kind of thing we want to keep alive, that kind of innovative outreach to the private sector. Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here today.